The British countryside is dappled with evidence of centuries past, even in the stones that scatter across the landscape. There are just dozens of places where you can practically feel the touch of people from long ago. Joining us now on Travel with Rick Steves to help us better understand what the stones have to teach us and to recommend some of his favorite ancient sites is archaeologist and tour guide Roy Nichols. Roy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rick.
When I walk around England, I get a sense that there are so many layers. I was just walking on Hadrian's Wall. When you walk along Hadrian's Wall, what do you think? What do you see?
It's the obvious things, like the wall itself and the forts and all the buildings that make up Hadrian's Wall. But for me, it's the reality of their connection with people. And this is something we shouldn't forget about, is that history isn't abstract, it's people.
It's real people. And you know, you think about this godforsaken corner of England, way up there where on the border of Scotland, basically. What, 1,800 years ago, the Romans decided to wall off the empire and build this wall from coast to coast. And then basically, I think well-off kids from good families got sent up there to be in the army.
Yes, it was the equivalent of the British in India throughout the 19th and earlier 20th century. It was the same similar sort of posting. It was where if you were a young, up-and-coming lad, you wanted to make a name for yourself in the army, that's where the action was, because there was more fighting, there was more action going on in the British Isles than any other part of the Roman Empire. There were four legions at any one time in Britain.
Now, our challenge is to go to these places and bring them to life. You can walk on Hadrian's Wall, and it's basically a beautiful walk. It's beautiful pastoral countryside and some dramatic cliffs and a lot of rocks that the Romans put there. Or you can imagine it with mile castles and chariots moving troops from mile to mile. And how do you bring it to life?
It's that connection with people who are no different from ourselves. It's a great linear city. It's a whole series of, yes, military fortifications. It had a military purpose.
Oh, the wall itself was a linear city. I see what you're
Well, see it
about.
As a linear city. And that's why I always describe it to people I take up there.
How long?
80 Roman miles, 72 and a half English miles. But it's the...
What are American miles?
About the same.
About the same. So we're running 70 miles. The wall actually had a road built onto it, didn't they?
The stain gate, that ran along. Well, it actually existed before the wall was built, and then they used it as a frontier.
I suppose just for a practical purpose, you couldn't effectively man a 70-mile-long wall, but you could move troops quickly.
Exactly. Think about the Maginot Line in 1940. The Germans just went round it. So any static defense is always a problem. And the Roman army didn't do well behind fortifications, but the fact is it's a barrier that they can act as a...
And Romans were really good at roads.
Exactly.
Like when you go to England as a tourist and you think of Britannia, that's the Roman name for that, right?
For that province,
2,000 years ago, it was the Roman province of Britannia. And you could have a road map of that. I mean, it was laced with roads.
Exactly. And many of our modern roads, the Romans built something like 10,000 miles in the province of Britain during their occupation.
10,000 miles of Roman roads.
Of various standards. And that's really, right through until the 20th century, is really about the same number of roads that we had.
And I was reading that they didn't have a grand plan as much as just looking for a high bluff. And then they would draw a straight line to that bluff. And they'd get to the top of that bluff, and then they'd figure out where they're going to go from that.
Yeah, I mean, we always think of Roman roads being dead straight, but they didn't. I mean, they didn't like curves. And obviously, to build the quickest route between two points is the straightest. They had really good surveyors, and they could lay out roads and be very, very accurate.
If you're traveling around England and you want to get goosebumps from ancient Rome, what are three or four sites that you would be sure to have on your list?
Obviously, Hadrian's Wall, because it's one of the great Roman sites throughout the great empire. Although we've got Roman remains all over North Africa and Europe and everywhere else, there's something unique about Hadrian's Wall, this great stone fortification with all the elements to it, both military and social.
I did my first real hike on it just a couple months ago, and it was marvelous because I got away from the museums and the tourists, and I was just all alone with that historic wonder.
I've been going there for 30 years, and I still get that shiver up and down my spine.
Marianne from Chicago emailed us, and she writes, I'd like to hike along Hadrian's Wall, all 70 or so miles, but the tours I've found require 8 to 10 miles per day, which is too much for me. Is there any way to do the hike at a somewhat slower pace and still find places to stay along the way?
Well, it's more of a remote area, so they aren't as frequent as some of the lowland areas, but you can still do it. And during the summer months, there is a shuttle service, a bus that plies along the wall that goes along to certain stops, the major fortifications and museums and things.
So that's good advice anywhere in England, is to incorporate your hike with shuttle buses and just local buses?
Local transport. So it'll take some sort of, obviously organization, but you can certainly do it quite easily.
Oh, yeah. And there's farmhouse B&Bs along the way and so on.
Exactly.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Roy Nichols about the wonders of ancient Britain. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. Dale's on the line in Blacklick, Ohio. Dale, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. I'm very interested in Mr. Nichols' comments about ancient Britain. My wife and I traveled in 2009 by a motor coach tour to Britain and Scotland. And among other things, we visited Avebury and Hadrian's Wall and found it very interesting and historical. We did not get to Stonehenge, but we're wondering what other sites you would recommend for a future trip.
Hello, Dale.
Hi.
Well, there are prehistoric remains, pre-Roman remains, all over Britain, and there isn't hardly an area other than industrial areas where you can't find standing stones and stone circles. But the south of England generally has one of the largest concentrations. It's no coincidence that Avebury and Stonehenge are in relatively close proximity. And there are lots of other less known sites scattered throughout that area.
I might interject that it was a blessing that Dale missed Stonehenge and went to Avebury, because just this year they're opening up a new centre at Stonehenge, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It's long awaited, I believe.
Well, it's been very, very controversial. And what the aim was originally was to try and remove too much of obvious modern stuff on the site and return the landscape to the way it would have been thousands of years ago, as close as we can to it. They're going to close one of the roads. And what they're going to open is really a compromise, but it is trying to remove too much of infringement on the site itself.
So you can be there surrounded by the wonder of Britain.
Exactly.
5,000 years ago.
Immerse yourself in all the other elements that make up, because it's more than just the stones. There are dozens of different elements that make up what we call ritual landscape.
As Dale would have found in Avebury, I think.
Exactly.
Dale, did you do some things other than the circle at Avebury?
We walked through the town there, Rick. We really enjoyed that. And there's a historical church, and there's a little cafe called the Red Lion, and we had free time, and we walked around and just soaked up the landscape. And we really liked the smaller towns and the villages in Europe.
You know, Roy was talking about, what was the term?
The ritual landscape.
Yeah, it's an ensemble. And if you could go up in an airplane and look down on it, it's like a big, vast community that all makes sense in a ritual.
You know, the standing stones and the henge monument, or what we call as a henge monument, is just one part of that element, makes up all these different things that we call the ritual landscape. It's burial mounds, it's other earthworks, it's standing stones. And some of these ritual landscape, certainly the one around Stonehenge and the one around Avebury, cover dozens of square miles.
And as Dale experienced, there's a little town right within all of that at Avebury.
Oh, yes.
You go to the pub and have a pint.
Now, if we go back, would you suggest a tour guide or doing it on our own or something
else?
Well,
you can do both, Dale. I mean, it's very easy to research. There's lots of good books on sites that you should see. Dartmoor is a very good place to go. There are some good concentrations of prehistoric monuments there. Now, you need some good maps. Good maps are always essential. Do a little bit of research about the area you might wish to go to, and I would suggest Dartmoor. There are some good standing stones there, stone circles, stone rows, and it does need some hiking because often they're away from...
But that's the beauty. I mean, everybody's been to Stonehenge, and until now it felt like a freeway rest stop, literally, because there's a big highway right next to it, 200 yards away from it. Now, you go to what Roy's talking, Dartmoor. Go to a place called Gidley.
Yes.
Yeah. G-I-D-L-E-I-G-H. Gidley. This is where I became a travel writer back when I was a kid. I went to Dartmoor and I hiked from the youth hostel and I found my own private stone circle after putting up with all the noise at Stonehenge.
Wow.
And I was all alone. I had to hike in about half an hour or so from the hostel. Hmm. But I had the most romantic experience. And then on the train out of there, heading over to Paris, I realized nobody knows about Gidley. Everybody goes to Stonehenge, and I just found my own little calling then.
Wow,
that was back in the 70s.
I love
that, Dale. If you can incorporate some of those, you know, get a good map and learn the key, and it'll show you where all these little faint remnants of that age survive.
And just explore a little on your own.
Yes, because, I mean, they are literally everywhere. We're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of monuments.
Would a car be essential?
It makes life easier because many of these are remote, and what you don't want to do if you're only going for 2 weeks is spend a lot of time traveling and trying to fit into other people's schedules, you know, the bus schedules and things.
Oh, for the ancient sites,
yeah.
I would go with a car. If you're lacing together cities, a car is a headache. But boy, if you want to get out into the countryside.
Exactly.
Hey, Dale, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy your program.
Thank you. And let us know how your next trip goes.
Okay,
bye now. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're finding ancient Britain with Roy Nichols. Roy, we've been talking about Roman Britain. We talked about, of course, Hadrian's Wall. I think it's important to remember London was a Roman town.
Yes, and increasingly, the Roman city of Londinium, we're beginning to realize that instead of it being a very quiet little provincial town, it was actually one of the most important towns in the western provinces.
It is interesting to think of the importance of Britain back then.
Oh, yes.
Emperor Constantine, wasn't he coronated in England?
Yeah, he was declared emperor in York in 306, I think, 306 AD. But, I mean, other emperors came to Britain. Emperor Claudius, Constans, the Emperor Severus was another one that came to Britain. So it was always an important province, not for all the right reasons sometimes. It had an important role in the Roman governance.
You know what one of my favorite Roman moments in Britain is?
What's that, Rick?
In Bath, in the museum, the Roman baths, looking at the golden statue of, is it Minerva?
Yeah, the goddess.
It's just like, it's magical. It's so vivid.
Yeah.
It's beautifully lit. But you realize there were real people here in Bath, Aquasulis.
And it's that, again, we mentioned it earlier, but the human element of it, you're not dealing with something that's abstract. You're dealing with people like ourselves.
And speaking of that, the Romans brought Christianity to Britain.
Well, one of the most important incidents or points in Roman history was when the Emperor Constantine the Great came to the throne because he was the first Christian emperor. And instead of being a cult that had been oppressed and persecuted for hundreds of years, it became the official religion of the empire.
Let's talk legendary. What about the Holy Grail and stuff?
The Holy Grail was the chalice used at the Last Supper. And
right.
The story goes that Joseph of Arimathea, one of the followers of Christ, after the death of Christ, brought it to England, this very remote little misty island on the very western edge of the Roman Empire.
But when people say that, I go, oh, yeah, right. But they actually had a trade connection, a reason to send guys to Britannia.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's not as if
they exported lead.
One of the most, it was metals generally, but the tin trade had begun with the Phoenicians, they think, going back hundreds of years before the Romans. And, of course, tin is an important element in making bronze. And there were other sources, but we've got some good evidence that, in fact, the tin from Cornwall and other parts of Britain was going out to the Mediterranean.
So it found its way all the way to Rome.
Exactly.
And Joseph was a tin merchant?
That's what the legend says.
He brought the Holy Grail, accordingly, to England then.
That's right.
And then what happened?
Well, he established the first Christian church in the little town of Glastonbury in the west of England.
So that's the important religiously of Glastonbury.
It certainly has a continuity of worship that is unparalleled anywhere else in the British Isles. But is that deep and very long connection with Christianity?
If you're inclined to believe in the Holy Grail, it would make sense to look for it around Glastonbury.
When and if it was lost, yes. But, I mean, even if the Grail didn't exist and is just a small element of it, certainly there was an early Christian church from that period.
And to go there today is a fascinating experience. In fact, you can read into a lot of churches and so on, a lot of what was there before Christianity came.
Yeah, because when Christianity was introduced, often what they would do is take pagan sites, what they called pagan sites, and give them a Christian perspective.
It only makes sense.
Exactly. I mean, and to make the transition from the old religion to the new religion easy.
Christmas and Easter just coincidentally happen to fall on pagan holidays.
Christmas is the festival of Mithras, the Roman god, and Easter, of course, is Eostre, who is the fertility goddess.
So if you have a Christian culture sort of overlaying on a pagan culture, it just would make sense to put your holy place on the holy place that was there before. And then you might have one of your saints that was sort of in charge of keeping down evil pagan spirits.
Well, they'd associate a modern Christian saint with that particular site. And often you'll get churches dedicated to St. Michael the Archangel. It's said to represent this long ago conflict between the pre-Christian religion and the Christianity.
So you're an archaeologist, and if you are trying to put the pieces together in this puzzle and you find some place in the middle of nowhere in the English countryside that has a church dedicated to St. Michael, you can sort of guess that that church was dedicated to St. Michael because Michael was necessary to overcome the paganness of that particular spot.
Well, I think it represents, and it might not be true of every church dedicated to St. Michael, but there are some that are actually built on prehistoric burial mounds.
So you could dig underneath that church. And
underneath it would be
a windfall for an archaeologist.
Yes.
You'd get in trouble with the pastor, but...
The Church of England would be very unhappy.
I'm Rick Steves. We're talking about burrowing under churches here with Roy Nichols to learn more about ancient Britain. And this isn't ancient, but to me it feels ancient because it's all ruined. And all over England you find these dramatic, romantic, ruined abbeys. What's our best approach to enjoying these abbeys?
Well, I mean, you can visit some of the more famous sites like Tintern and Fountains Abbey in Yorkshire, Rivo, Gervaux. But remember, there were something like 500 abbeys and priories, monasteries of all sizes.
You said Rivo and Cherbourg.
Gervaux.
Are those French names?
Well, the Cistercian monasteries that have a French foundation to them.
So these monastic orders had they were spread all over Europe.
All over Europe, yeah.
So it was a network that provided a cohesiveness.
Well, it was one order,
right?
With a head of the order who would then control all the abbeys, regardless of which country they were in. And that was the problem for many of the sort of rulers in Europe, was the church was independent and it was powerful. And it crossed national borders.
So it really got in the way of a lot of kings, and kings had a very simple solution, dissolution. And all over Europe, you read about the dissolution of the monasteries. The king finally got fed up and he said, okay, you guys are out of business. And in England, they just trashed the beautiful churches at the monasteries.
And not just the political element to it, but also the fact that they were incredibly wealthy. And when kings start wanting more money for wars and all the other things they do, then, of course, this is an easy sort of income.
And what do you do with the abbey in the case of Glastonbury?
Well, it was dissolved, but that's a euphemism for basically being closed down, pensioning off all the monks.
And what about the abbot, the guy who ran it? What would you do to him?
Well, Richard Whiting, well, most abbots and heads of the various orders would actually go away. But in his case, Richard Whiting was hung, drawn, and quartered for his pains because he opposed the king.
Hung, drawn, and quartered.
Exactly. It's a pretty gruesome death.
We don't do that anymore.
Only for certain offences.
What is actually quartered?
Yes, you would be hung until you weren't quite dead, cut down while you were still alive, disemboweled. That's the drawing.
Disemboweled, what does that mean?
Eviscerated, your stomach be cut open and all your entrails taken out and burnt before your eyes. And then when you were finally dead, you'd be chopped up into pieces, dipped in tar to preserve your body, and it would be taken to various parts of the kingdom to show to anybody what happened to traitors.
So the abbot of Glastonbury got cut in four pieces and sent on four national tours at the same time.
Yes, it's the ultimate holiday, I suppose.
And the king got his way.
And the king always got his way.
And today, as tourists, we can not only see the ruined abbey, but learn about what happened to the abbot who stood in the way of the king. Thanks, Roy.
Thank you, Rick.
Each year, Rick Steves' tour guides take free-spirited travelers on escorted tours through England, Scotland, Ireland, and beyond, one small group at a time. This year, we're featuring tours of the best of Ireland, the best of Scotland, the best of England, and London. For a free catalogue and Rick's Tour Experience DVD, visit the tour pages at ricksteves.com.